wanted to start off by asking you, how many of you believe in elephants? Would you all say you believe in elephants? Okay, some aren't quite sure what to commit to, and that's okay. I think Brother Henry warned me a little bit that y'all might be scared to help me, or at least he said the youth, so that's fine. How many of you have seen an elephant? Actually seen an elephant, okay, good. So, you know, there is such a thing, good. Now, would you say there's a difference between hearing about elephants and seeing elephants? Would you say that? We could give you all the measurements, all the weight, and all the statistics, but until you see one, it's pretty difficult to really know what an elephant is, isn't it? I mean, we can say it has a long nose, a longer nose than a tail, but how often do you see that? If you've never seen one, it's okay. Now, I would suggest to you that I've seen elephants in zoos, so on, captivity quite a bit. But probably the first time I felt like I really saw an elephant, or plural in this case, was when I was in the Maasai Mara in Kenya, in what suddenly seemed like a very small jeep beside a very large group of elephants. It put them into a little different perspective than when they're behind a big fence and I'm standing probably usually higher in a zoo, looking down on them. You know, it put it in a different perspective. Now, I have a story of a man that lived in Africa, so he was, I guess you could say, familiar with elephants. One time, he decided to experience elephants in a different way. He knew where they crossed the river, so he got a snorkel, and he went and right in the river where these wild elephants crossed, and he went in the water and hid in the water as they came, and they walked all around him. Now, it was probably a pretty dumb thing to do, actually. But he said that the one big matriarch, the leader of that herd of elephants, basically came nose to nose with him, and as he looked into her eye, she just decided to not do anything with him, I guess. But you could say, in a way, that fellow probably experienced elephants in a way none of us here has, right? And I'm not really sure I have a strong desire to experience elephant on that level. I don't know. I'd like to think that was maybe a bit foolish. I'm quite content with the experience I had for the most part. So I'd like for you to consider consider that thing. Have you, you've seen elephants, some of you have you experienced elephants? And I'll come back to that in a bit. So I tell you something I wonder about more than elephants is when I come to a new community like this, sometimes I wonder why I'm here. And you could take that question in a lot of ways. Very few of you actually know me personally. There's a couple of you that could say you've met me. We've had a good visit with one or two of you. So I don't know what your expectations were, what brought about the invitation that brought me here. I hope it's more than that I just owe you one, even though I'm happy to pay debts where I can. What made a group of people like you willing to give up the evenings of this week? And I'm going to be, I hope, humble enough to hope that it's far more than just listening to me speak, right? How do you know that you're not just wasting your week? I don't know about you, but while I can very much enjoy revival meetings, even the very best speaker, I'm sort of glad we don't have them every evening. Finally, I have some other things to do in the evening too, correct? And some of them maybe times maybe if they go too long like I can, it's like, oh, I could get some sleep, you know? So after this week, I'm guessing, I don't know how, it seems a bit unfair sometimes when I have to share that, I don't know, your attendance over there at least was 107 once and 105 the other time, so let's say there's roughly that many people here. Seems a bit unfair that at the end of the week, there's going to be 105 people that are going to probably say, yeah, they know who Joe Bauman is. And I don't know, hope I gained a little bit, but probably not going to be able to say 105, right? Will you really know me better? Perhaps you will. But if you really wanted to know me, what steps would you take? You could ask my wonderful wife, Debbie. She's along with me. You could get knowledge of me through her. You could talk to my daughters. That might actually be your better option. They have a lot to say, and some of it's not all dad approved. Especially for 4-year-old. Actually, even the 15-year-old that's at home sometimes has a bit of that, but she's not here to defend herself. So I've got 4 daughters. 15, yeah, let's see, what are the others? 10 and 8. And then 4. So you could learn from them. At the same time, if you really wanted to know me, would that do it? I suggest you would need to know a bit more, wouldn't you? You could get knowledge, but could you really know me through them? I didn't know. I sometimes travel with some things. This is one thing that was in my vehicle. I was planning to bring it in before most of you were sitting here, but it didn't work out since I was a little late. But do y'all know something about me now that I brought this along with me? Anyone? What do you think this tells you about me, that I have something like this in my vehicle?
Like to fish.
Like to fish, there you go. And I actually do, yeah. In fact, I just got to thinking, Georgia's one place I haven't caught a fish yet, so maybe I need to try it if I could find a good pond or something. So I wanted to shift a little bit now, talking about fishing rather than myself. Does anyone here know everything about fishing? Anyone know everything about fishing? What if I told you I did? I know all about fishing. Would you believe me? What would I have just told you about myself? But I have an inflated opinion about my knowledge, right? I would say, probably for the time I've had to do it, I don't know if this is good or bad. Sometimes I wonder. But I would say I could probably stack up favorably to anybody my age group. Or fishing knowledge, I don't know. But it still doesn't mean that I know everything about fishing. I can tell you, for those of you that wonder, that this is called a Texas rig. I can tell you that this is tied on a fluorocarbon leader with a uniknot down onto the braid. And, you know, I can keep going. It's getting pretty boring for some of these people that don't like fishing. Who's the hardest person to teach something to? It's the one who already knows everything, right? I just got done telling you that none of us knows everything about fishing. Does any of us know anything about everything? No, we don't. Now, granted, I have met some people that put on a pretty good imitation of seeming like they had, but the fact is none of us knows everything. I'd like to have a thought here that if you have space in your brain, I'd like for you to stick it in there and chew on it. Think about it. The wisest person is the one who knows enough to know that they know very little, even about things they know a lot about. Is that true? In fact, I probably have a pet peeve, and yet I probably have struggled with coming across that way sometimes. Is that people that know everything, seemingly, of course, in quotations, are actually quite difficult to love and appreciate sometimes. I don't know if you find it that way, but for me, I can struggle with it when it's anybody but me anyways. The wisest person is the one who knows enough to know that they know very little, even about things they know a lot about. I've been challenged by that, friends, this evening. I really didn't know if I have any business trying to have revival meetings, because the last couple years, and sometimes even the last couple months, it seems with some intensity, God has been teaching me that I know nothing at all. And so it seems sort of arrogant or something to travel, I don't know exactly, we made a loop through Florida, so it's not, you can get to Arkansas a little faster than that, but I'm going to say somewhere between 8 to 10 hours. Seems a little arrogant to drive 8 to 10 hours to ask 105 people to devote 40 minutes, an hour, listening to me when I don't know anything. How silly. Wouldn't we be better off just staying at home or finding somebody that does know something? And yet in that process, as I asked God about this problem, you know, one thing I think he's trying to tell me is that, Joe, it's fine for you not to know anything as long as you know me. And friends, I don't know what you expect this week, but one thing I want you to know is to know my daddy, if I can say it that way, because he knows everything. I don't. You know, I'm not trying to get political at all here, but a couple weeks ago, there was something that blessed me in the political realm, and I won't name names, but there was somebody that's on the national political stage was giving a speech, and he had I think it was late teen son that's somewhat mentally handicapped. And as this individual was up giving maybe one of the prime speeches of his life, this, I think he was 17 years old boy, was off to the side, tears running down his face, pointing up there and saying, "That's my dad. That's my dad." And regardless of how you think or feel about people's political stance and all that, I'm not here to get into that. Friends, tonight, that's all I can really do in this week of meetings, is to stand here and say, "That's my dad." Because I don't have anything. And sometimes we may feel that a bit more keenly than we do at other times, and that's okay. But at the end of the day, even on my wisest, best spoken day, friends, I really have nothing to tell you except, "That's my dad." You know, quite some years ago, there was a missionary that traveled to the city of Athens. And as he walked through the city and he saw how the people there spent their time, their energy, their resources, I think that if I recall the scripture correctly, it says his heart was stirred within him. And as he walked through the city, he even found an altar among probably hundreds, I don't know, maybe thousands of others. There was one dedicated to the unknown God. And that evidently made an impression on the Apostle Paul, because whenever he had the opportunity to speak, he brought up this altar dedicated to the unknown God. You know, the people of Athens, and it says the strangers too, the ones that were visiting, were so committed to knowing about everything, it said they spent all their time in hearing or seeing something new, or they thought they did. And it seems they were so fearful of missing some knowledge that they called knowledge, that they even had special place for the ones they didn't know. So they could have said, "Yeah, we're humble. See, we got an altar for the unknown God. We left some room for the unknown here." Yet at the same time, these people were idolizing what they knew. Knowledge is even, if you look back history, Athens was very much the seat of philosophy at that time. It's where people wanted to know things. And while it's great to know things, let me tell you something, friends, tonight. Knowledge, without knowledge of God, is rather a pitiful thing. As Paul tried to show them, but they weren't willing to hear, because they idolized knowledge. So, I don't want to be offensive, and it's probably one of the lamest things you can do is to go to a Mennonite church and ask people, "Do you know God?" But I would like to ask you this evening, do you know God? Do you know God? Far too often, let me back up. It's just fine to say that an elephant in a zoo is adequate for me. To say that an elephant outside the jeep that I'm in a safari is adequate for me. I don't want to go in the river. I don't want to run around through their legs. I don't want to experience being thrust under their trunk like some people have. But when it comes to God, Are we content to let God in the zoo? Yes, we want to see. We want to hear about. We love the statistics. We're thrilled with the opportunity to say we saw an elephant. We know something about God. But we're quite content to stop there. Has what I have seen of God changed me? Changed me from what I was to something else? Changed how I think? Changed how I live? And you know, friends, probably the hardest person to really challenge their view of God is the ones that know, think they know a lot about God. Am I willing to be basic, to be childlike, and just, do I know God? I'd like for you to open your Bibles to Job. We'll just begin at chapter 1. Before I begin reading Job, I'd like to for you to think a moment with me. What formed your view of God? Let's see, we got a marker. Can anybody help me here? What are some things that formed your view of God, whatever it is? Anyone?
His word.
His word? We'll just call that the word. Oops. Anything else?
Creation.
Any more?
His work.
I think some of you are thinking too hard. There should be some pretty basic ones. Okay, parents, thank you. Some more? Any else come to mind?
Experiences.
Okay, that's good for now. We could, I'm sure, make a longer list. Let's think about this just a minute before we go into Job. So if we find God in his word, does that mean that everybody that reads the Bible knows God? No, I know of many people that have read the Bible as a piece of literature. I don't know. Whatever. Even as a curiosity. Doesn't mean that just reading the word will show you God. It takes something more, even though that's great. Spend time in the Word. Does spending time or seeing creation mean that you know God? Otherwise, at least there'd be a lot more people that would know God, right? Let's say it that way. There's lots of hunters and fishermen and what else that know something about creation that have not, unfortunately, found God. Okay, this one's maybe going to be harder for me. Does every life that God works in know God? No, we know it doesn't. In fact, it tells us that God's work, you know, I'm paraphrasing some scriptures, but his work is an opportunity to know him. At the same time, it's not a force to know him. What about parents? You know, isn't that one of the saddest things, especially as a parent, as my girls get older, I love them dearly. But, you know, I'm glad for the freedom of choice, but it's also hard to realize that my children have the opportunity to turn away. Just having parents that believe that know God doesn't say it's a given. It can be definitely a help. And if you have children, please, by all means, follow God with all your heart. Best thing you can do, but it's not given. What about experiences? You know, there's lots of life experiences. Again, That's not necessarily how we know God. So think about some of these things. Let's go on into Job here. Job is probably one of my favorite books of the Bible, especially for the Old Testament, thinking about that. I don't know. Fills a huge spot for me. So let's just look at Job chapter 1, verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright and one that feared God and eschewed evil. So I don't know if we know exactly who wrote the book of Job. But we have this testimony about Job. And just in case you're worried that Job wrote it, let's jump down to verse 8 and see what God personally had to say about Job. And the Lord said unto Satan, "Hast thou considered my servant Job? There is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil." I don't know if God would say that about you. Would that be special? I hope so. I was sort of wishing in some ways that he could say that about me. But then I got to thinking, I was like, if God would brag on me, I don't know if I want the rest of what goes with it. Yet we have this true witness of what Job was, an outstanding follower of God, strong in faith, tremendous willingness to suffer, just a faith almost beyond belief, how he hung in there. I want you to know, as I look at the rest of this, I have a tremendous admiration and appreciation for Job. Yet perhaps what blesses me the most about Job isn't actually his strong qualities, but his weakness, if you want to call it that way. So let's look at this a bit more. I don't nearly think I have faith like Job did. But yet, as Job worked through this difficult time in his life, I saw some tendencies in Job that Job has very, very much. Let's skip down. I'm not going to read the whole book for you. So let's jump down to verse 20 through 22 now. Y'all know what happened, right? Messengers coming with everything wiped out, first possessions, finally children, everything lost. Chapter 1, verse 20 through 22. Then Job arose after he got all this bad news, the very worst day of his life, I'm sure. Then Job arose, rent his mantle, shaved his head, fell down on the ground, and worshiped. And said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. How amazing if Job could have just stayed there. And he probably wished he could have. Well, it wasn't all over yet. Again, chapter 2, verse 3. Have another meeting. And the Lord said unto Satan, "Hast thou considered my servant Job? There is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil. And still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movest me against him to destroy him without a cause." Second testimony. Well, we know that God basically released or unleashed, I'm not sure how I should say that, Satan to do whatever he wanted, only spare his life was the condition. And devil's pretty good at making life tough when God takes that hedge away. Let's go down to verse 9 and 10. Then said his wife, Job's wife, unto him, "Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die." So now here we have a man that has not only lost everything he had a day ago. I don't know how much time was here. Very brief time ago. Lost everything. Lost his family. Still had his wife, I guess you could say. But she's saying, "Job, this is beyond bearing. Are you still trying to hang on to your belief in God? Just curse God. Tell him what you think about this and then die." probably indicating suicide. But he, Job, said unto her, thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In this did not Job sin with his lips. Friends, in verse 10, I love Job's attitude, but Job left just a little bit of a wrong concept slip into his view of God that took him places that he shouldn't have gone. You know, James chapter 1, verse 13 tells us that God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. Did you notice how in verse 10, Job said, what? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? Job somehow in his, and I don't blame it all, but somehow he saw God as being complicit in what he was experiencing. And yes, I don't know, it seems like in our circles we have a big problem with this. I'll just be blunt with you. But there's a big difference between what God allows and what God does. And I think we have to separate that, or it puts us on a path where I don't want to go. A small misconception. So notice where this progression led. Chapter 3 now, verse 1 through 4. Chapter 3, verse 1. After this opened Job his mouth and cursed his day. So he kept faith in God, but he decided he had had it with the day, okay? And Job spake and said, let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, there is a man-child conceived. Let the day be darkness, let not God regard it from above, neither let light shine upon it. Let's go down to verse 9 through 13. Let the stars of the twilight thereof be dark. Let us look for light that but have none, neither let it see the dawning of the day, because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid sorrow from mine eyes. Why died I not from the womb? Why did not I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees not prevent me, adding that, or the breast that I should suck? For now should I have lain still and be quiet. I should have slept when I had been at rest. Oh, that I had never been born. Oh, that if I had been born, I would have died at birth. Oh, that if I wouldn't have died at birth, that I would have died from starvation before I faced this. Can the thing formed say, why hast thou made me thus? Let's go on to chapter 7, verse 11 through 16. Job chapter 7, verse 11. Through 16. Job speaking again. Therefore, I will not refrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I a sea or a whale that thou settest to watch over me? When I say, my bed shall comfort me, my couch shall ease my complaint, then thou scarest me with dreams and terrifiest me through visions, so that my soul chooseth strangling and death rather than life. I loathe it. I would not live always. Let me alone, for my days are vanity. Oh, that I could die. Oh, God, you're responsible for what I'm experiencing. Why can't you just let me alone so I can die? Don't forget, this is the person to whom God had such a wonderful witness about. Remember? This was a man that we would have said knows God. So hang in there with me. Let's go to chapter 10 and keep thinking. This is all coming from somebody that thought he knew God. Chapter 10, verse 18 through 20. Job chapter 10, verse 18. Wherefore, then hast thou brought me forth out of the womb? Oh, that I had given up the ghost and no eye had seen me, that I would have just miscarried. I should have been as though I had not been. I should have been carried away from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Cease then. Let me alone, that I might take a little comfort. You know, I don't live very long, God. My life is passing fast. Why can't you just let me have a few days of peace? Chapter 13, verse 3. So we have a Job, notice the progression here. He goes from complaining about his day. Well, let me back up. He goes from having a small misconception about how God was involved in his view of his struggles, to complaining about his day, to wishing he hadn't been born, to wishing he could die. Now, notice this. To wishing God would just let him alone. Now, verse chapter 13, verse 3. Surely I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God. Notice the progression. Now he would like to reason with God. And at least, I'm not Job, but I've been at this place where I would like to reason with God. And what that means to me is, God, I've got a thing or two I could ask you. If you would give me the opportunity, I think you owe me an explanation. Let's go to chapter 16, verse 11 through 14. Job chapter 16, verse 11 now, through 14. God hath delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he hath broken me asunder. He hath also taken me by the neck and shaken me to pieces and set me up for his mark. His archers compass me about. He cleaveth my reins asunder and doth not spare. He poureth out my gall upon the ground. He breaketh me with breach upon breach. He runneth upon me like a giant. So here, Job, the man that we would have said knew God, really comes out and explains how he was viewing God. He's saying that God delivered me up to the ungodly. He's saying God turned me over to the wicked. And in a way, you can say that. And in a way, you can. It wasn't accurate. But he says, he turned me over to the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he hath broken me asunder. He hath taken me by the neck. What he's literally saying is, have you ever seen a dog, I don't know, catch a rat or a small animal? Just grab it and shake it. He's saying, that's what's happening to me. His archers, he set people around me and they're shooting me and God's doing this. He pouring me out on the ground. He breaketh me as breach upon breach, just like huge waves slamming into me time after time. He blames God for this, for deserting him, for giving him over, for persecuting him. Now let's go to chapter 19, verse 21 through 24. Chapter 19, verse 21 through 24. Have pity upon me, have pity upon me, O ye my friends, for the hand of God hath touched me. Why do you persecute me as God? And are ye not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they were printed in a book, that they were graven with an iron pen and laid in a rock forever. Have pity upon me. He's almost saying, you know, you, my friends, could at least have pity on me. Evidently, God doesn't have time for me. God doesn't understand me. Can't you at least? Why do you persecute me as God? And then he sort of sets up, you know, I wish somebody would record this. I wish somehow this could be saved. I've got a real grievance here. Interestingly enough, how many thousands of years later are we reading this? God answers some things we don't always expect, right? Maybe he put it there for me. Let's go to chapter 23 now, verse 1 through 5. Chapter 23, verse 1 through 5. Then Job answered and said, even today is my complaint bitter. My stroke is heavier than my groaning. In other words, I'm not making it as bad as it is. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, talking of God, that I might come even to his seat. I would order or argue my cause before him and fill my mouth with arguments or reasons. I would know the words with which he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Here was a man that thought he knew God. Yet when God, I guess we could say, allowed these things in his life, He had a case. And he sort of climaxes in chapter 24, verse 12. So let's read that yet. Chapter 24, verse 12 is, at least to me, somewhat of a climax of Job's argument or a progression in his thoughts of how he viewed God. Men groan from out of the city, and the soul of the wounded crieth out, yet God layeth not folly to them. In other words, God doesn't hear him. God just doesn't hear him. He accuses God of being indifferent to wickedness. Well, we have all Job's friends in there going on, which we're not focused on tonight. So let's just turn in our Bibles to Job chapter 38. When Job finally got his desire, he didn't have to go where God was. God came to him. And you know, it's sort of odd. And in my life, I'll just tell you, I find it somewhat similar. That we spend all this time building up, and we wonder, where is God? And he's there all along, because listen, when he starts talking, very evidently he knew all that had happened. Job chapter 38, verse 1 through 5. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me." So you want to talk to me, Job? Here's your chance. Be a man. Come on. "Where wast thou when I laid the foundation of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it?" He goes on and on. When God starts asking you questions, I tell you what, he asks real questions. And I don't know if there's any answers, at least from a man's perspective. Anyway, we could read a lot here. Let's just turn over to chapter 40. Chapter 40, verse 2. God continues to question Job. Well, we'll just read verse 1, chapter 40, verse 1 and 2. "Moreover, the Lord answered," or we could say continued, talking to Job, "and said, Shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him, and he that reproveth God, let him answer it?" Job had just basically begged or challenged God to a dialogue, and God says, "Here I am." Now, can you really carry out what you wanted to do? Let's notice Job's response to God now in verse 3. "Then Job answered the Lord and said, Behold, I am vile. I'm wicked. I'm worth nothing. What shall I answer thee? I will lay mine hand upon my mouth." In other words, I'll just shut up. I'll be quiet. "Once have I spoken, but I will not answer. Yea, twice, but I will proceed no farther. Yes, God, I did talk, and I talked out of turn." God didn't let it there. Verse 6. "Then answered the Lord unto Job out of the whirlwind and said, Gird up thy loins now like a man, and I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me." Come on, Job. You had a lot to say a very short time ago. Now here's your opportunity. Verse 8. "Wilt thou also disannul my judgment? Wilt thou condemn me that thou mayest be righteous? Hast thou an arm like God, or canst thou thunder with a voice like him?" We keep going. Let's turn over to chapter 42 now. And please, if you're getting a little sleepy or distracted on me, please wake up and pay attention to these six verses here. Chapter 42, verse 1 through 6. "Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge?" In a way, it's done as question form, but it's a question that who has hidden counsel without knowledge? In other words, it's me. "Therefore, I uttered that I understood not things too wonderful for me, which I do not. Here I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand," or it means I will ask of you, "and declare thou unto me. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." Please bear with me a little bit in my foolish way of saying this, but you know, friends, Job had so sincerely and so heartily walked after God that he thought he knew everything about fishing. And I'm not at all trying to put myself in God's perspective, but one reason that I think God allowed Satan to do those things was because God needed to take that knowledge away from Job so that Job could really have knowledge of him. And how oftentimes, my friends, is what we think we know about God hindering God from continuing his work in my life? I don't know about you, but for me it happens way too often. Where Job starts thinking he knows a little bit something. Where he thinks he's got a little wisdom, a little experience, a little knowledge, whatever it is. And God in his love and mercy just wipes that slate clean and leaves me sitting there feeling empty. God, what just happened? And yet, that's a process that's so necessary, my friends. Because notice, Job of all people, even with God's testimony of him, in verse 42, or chapter 42, verse 5, he says, I've heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Dear friends, tonight, if you're sitting in this church, I can almost guarantee you have heard about God through the hearing of the ear. But that in no way means that you have seen God, that you have experienced God. And that's my fear for myself, my concern for you. How many of us have seen God, have experienced God? Job. Such a tremendous example of faith, of steadfast commitment, so much right, so much good, yet so much to grow. What was really, at the beginning, what could we have picked fault with Job, really? The only thing I can come up with is just a tiny bit of overconfidence in his understanding of who God was and how God worked. That's really the only thing I could come up with. Notice the lengths that God went to bring Job to see himself. You know, there's a verse in Hebrews that I don't like at all, but it says, whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and chastiseth every son whom he receiveth. He goes on to tell us that if we don't face chastisement, of which all are partakers, then we're not legitimate sons of God. I don't know what your journey with God is like. I don't know what you're facing in your life. I do know that if God loves you, it's not going to be easy for you, right? You know, was Job, was any understanding and knowledge I have wrong? No. Understanding and knowledge of God is not wrong. But when I have confidence in them to where I think I know something, they then become a hindrance in allowing God to continue his work in me. God has no option if he really loves me other than knocking those props out. I came up with three quick ways for me to know whether I have only heard or whether I have seen and experienced God. And I would be open, if you disagree with me, you're welcome to challenge me. But here's three tests that in my life help me find out whether I have only heard of God or whether God is helping me see and experience him. The first one is, a person who's only heard of God will be defensive. A person who's only heard of God will be defensive. We could go back to Job. You know, when his friends falsely accused him, and by the way, it was false, their accusations for the most part. Job answered. Why wasn't he just quiet? Think of Christ before Pilate. So many times, you know, defensiveness comes from someone that has not really seen God. Number two, test for myself and whether I have just heard or whether I'm seeing and experiencing God. Is if I've only heard, I will be insecure around those who feel differently. It's very similar to the first, but maybe just building on it a bit, in that I will have to do a lot of explaining. I will have to do a lot of convincing. I'll be insecure around those who feel differently. I can't just stand on truth and let it there. Then the third test for someone, whether if you're asking yourself, have I actually seen God? Or I might just have I heard of him, is if I'm only heard of him, I will seek to justify and protect my thoughts and actions. I will seek to justify and protect my thoughts and actions rather than just saying, yes, God, here I am. Yes, I have a struggle with that. Yes, whatever. I will need to justify and protect my thoughts and actions. Friends, if you find yourself being defensive, if you find yourself being insecure, trying to convince others who feel differently, it's one thing to present truth. It's another thing to try to convince others against their will. If you're trying to justify and protect your thoughts and actions, do something for me tonight. Go home. Find a quiet place. Get down on your knees and ask God to just let you see him, to experience him. You know, just talking with a friend, we were sharing some pretty deep things. And I was telling him about some of my struggles. And I said, I'm trying to figure out what is God telling me, because I have prayed a prayer where, God, if you want me to do this, just help me be willing to just give everything up to follow you. On the other hand, I've also told God, if there's something in my life that you need to prune, to take away, just do it. And so now is God telling me, which of these is he doing? Actually, I think God being God, he's probably doing both. And my friend was like, do you actually pray that? And for just a split second, I had a little bit of pride, and I said, yeah. And I thought, whoops. I did pray that. And yet, in God's refining process, I'm going to be honest with you, I'm almost scared to keep praying it. Because he answers, and he don't answer how Joe thinks he ought to sometimes. I sort of get my ideas how God could do stuff. And yet God's got a different idea, and when he works that out, sometimes it about wipes this man out. Sometimes it's just too different. God, I can't handle this. Can I just surrender it? Let me ask you this. When was the last time you were totally, completely dependent on God without any option or choice of turning elsewhere? You know, as humans, we will do almost anything other than reach the end of our resources and have nothing but God. How I have tried. How hard do I make it for God to get my attention? How hard do you make it for God to touch you? We live in a world that has multitudes of ways of protecting our possessions, right? Y'all came through a storm. At least I was in your local town here this afternoon a little bit, and they were talking. I guess maybe not have as bad as some. But, you know, in this culture we live in and around us, I'm not talking our specific church culture now, the wise people have insurance. They got it all figured out how to protect their possessions, and even if it's all gone, they still think they can get it back. How hard do I make it for God to touch my possessions? I don't know if I totally agree with this. I heard one speaker one time say, don't protect your possessions too well, because if God can't get your attention there, he'll go to your family. And, you know, guess what? I'd much rather you lose a couple trucks than a daughter. So I don't know. Like I said, I'm not promoting that completely. At the same time, God does sometimes touch our family. Have we given them to God? Wife, daughter, whatever it is for you. Another thing God can touch for some people's health. Maybe reputation. You know, good reputation is a pretty precious thing, ain't it? Did you give it to God? It's not yours after all. It may be about you, but it's not yours. How hard do we make it for God to touch us? What does he have to take for us to realize that really all of life is about him and not about me? Do you actively seek to know God? Do I ask God to show yourself to me? Friends, tonight, do you know what it is to have nothing between you and a yawning abyss of worse than nothingness except God? Except God. Probably one of the times I faced this the most was as a young man. I'm still not old, thankfully, but I was a little younger than I am now. And I was at a program, and you know, I was at a stage in life where I still wondered what life would hold, and I had some dreams, some aspirations that I was really hoping would work out. And yet I was worried. I've had some crashes at that point already, and I just didn't know what was going to happen next. I don't know, something about the songs in that program spoke to me. And finally, it was too much just to stay sitting in there. I went out behind that church house, you know, inside the church house, sort of odd thinking about it now. There was 400 or 500 people in the church house, and out behind the church house was one man alone. And I just told God he could have it all. He could just have it all. It's probably one of the hardest things I ever did. I'm glad I did it. But you know, one problem is I've found it necessary to do it again and again. I sort of wish that that once would have gone a little bit longer. But Joe started taking it off the table again, and he needed to put it back again. And he needs to put it back again. And sometimes God asks him to give up stuff he didn't even know he was hanging on to. It makes me think of young children. You know, I was watching my daughters. Oh, it's so born into us as human beings to, we have something that's precious to us and God wants us to share it, or maybe parents in their case. And you know what happens? They're there and they see somebody else eyeing their toy and they go, mine. Mine. How often have I done that with my life? How often have I done that with even things that I thought I was doing for God? Mine. When God in his love and mercy just keeps waiting on Joe to open that hand and say, yours. Do you know what it is to have nothing but God? Do you know what it is to have no one to turn to? No friend that understands, no strength, no wisdom. No knowledge, no security, no hope, nothing but God. You know, to a non-Christian, that's an awful bleak picture, isn't it? And to even a Christian, that's pretty tough. But oh, the joy, the peace that can be found when we have nothing but God. I don't know. As parents, it seems a couple of our daughters went through a challenging stage as it related to discipline. My wife, I think halfway humorously, likes to tell me that women have higher pain tolerance than men, but when it comes to discipline, my daughters didn't do a good job of supporting her theory. And we had one or two that would absolutely, maybe we did something wrong, I don't know. But they came to a point in discipline where they would absolutely panic to rebel when disciplined, just out of hand, really. And it was about one of the hardest things that this father has ever done is to just continue the discipline till they broke. I felt it was necessary. I still think so. And yet to find the peace and the rest that that child had when they finally gave up. I want to ask you tonight, you don't know me, you know yourself, so you probably can't answer this for me, but it's perhaps when it feels like that discipline just goes on and on and on, it's because I'm not holding still for God. I'm not just saying, Daddy, whatever you want. You know, the man, Paul, who so many years ago witnessed the idolatry of knowledge at Athens and the futile efforts of man to cover all the bases, said this sometime later as he considered his personal walk with God. And of all the people you can read about in Scripture, of all the people that you could find in history, of all the people you could know today, you would probably say the Apostle Paul of all people knew God, right? But note, let me just read to you Philippians chapter 3, verse 10. I just hear Paul's heart cry here, that I might know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings being made conformable unto his death. I could read a lot more there. Philippians chapter 3 is one of the most awesome passages in Scripture. But I tell you tonight, friends, that's been one of my long-standing prayers, and I would suggest that if you really want to know God, make it yours too, that I might know him. Nothing else is worth knowing. In fact, any other knowledge you can have is useless unless you know him. And Paul, with all his knowledge, with all his gifts, with all his talents, with all his experience, is standing there in Philippians chapter 3, verse 10, saying, oh, that I might know him. He was willing, it says elsewhere, that he counts everything but dung that he might win Christ. Friends, tonight, I don't care what's in your past. I don't care whether it's good or bad, unless it's all behind you. All just nothing and nothing but him. It's useless. You know, far too many Christians today are serving an unknown God. Not unknown in the sense that they don't know about him, but unknown in that we have heard, but we have not really experienced, we've not really committed ourselves completely to him and his control. We're far too often satisfied. We're far too often fearful even of knowing, of seeing, of experiencing him. God is offering me, he's offering you the opportunity to explore the unlimited vastness of himself. But we hold back because we're scared of what it costs. And yet without him, we have nothing. So how can I see God? I've got four steps here that I think work for me. Again, take them to God. If he shows you something different, that's fine. But those starting place, if you're wondering here tonight, have I ever seen God? I've generally heard about him. Here's what you can do. When you find yourself facing difficult things in life, number one is stop. Stop trying to figure it out. Stop trying to find a way through, around, whatever. Stop fighting. Number two, I'm keeping these basic, I know, is surrender. Stop, then surrender. Just take it to God and say, God, here's this tangled mess. It doesn't make any sense. It's all wrong. Whatever you want to say about it, say it. But make sure that you say, Lord, I lay it all down. I just give it all to you. Number three is trust. Guess what, friends? Trust doesn't mean that I see how this works. It doesn't mean that it makes sense to me. It doesn't even mean that I call it good. But trust means that I trust. Trust means that as I surrender and I lay that down, I keep it open and I just allow him to have it. And I come to point four, which is definitely involved in trust, is just wait. Wait on God. And when I say wait, I'm not talking about procrastination. Perhaps that is a problem for some of us. But I say probably a greater problem for more of us is a thing of just waiting on God to just work in our lives. We want so bad to move somewhere, to do something, to have something happen that we forget to wait. So, pretty basic, isn't it? Stop. Surrender. Trust and wait. Is that something we can do? Is that something we can understand? I'll tell you something about myself here. You know, while to some degree and in many ways my understanding and experience of and with God has increased, I find that my knowledge, what I think I know about God, has decreased. What I could have confidently told you about God and his ways some years ago, I'm probably going to be a bit more cautious today. In fact, recently, not so long ago, my wife and I were listening to a good friend of mine preach. And he's about my age. And my wife afterwards made the comment. She said, it's funny. He sort of sounds like you anymore. You know what? Nothing against you, but I sometimes almost feel bad when I think. I was ordained pretty young, and when I think back of some of the things I preached in my 20s and early 30s, and thought, Joe, you thought you knew something, didn't you? I hit 40 last year, and I just don't know anything anymore. I just don't know anything at all. I'm not sure. Sometimes I think the church should get another preacher because I just don't know anything. But yet, there's my daddy. He knows something, right? And that's fine. God lets us all grow, doesn't he? God hasn't changed, friends. That's not what I'm saying and what I just said. But he's changing me. He's teaching me. He's showing me himself. The more I know, the less certain I am about what I know, because I know there's so much more to know. So much, and I'll just say this about myself, so much of what I thought I knew, I am discovering was a God of my own making. That sounds pretty awful, doesn't it? A God of my invention, something I wanted to believe because of how I wanted to be. And God needs to take that away. You know, when I prayed and asked God, oh, that I might just know you, he heard. He heard, and he didn't answer the prayer the way I thought he would, but he's answering it. Is that my prayer, that I might know him? Is that my breath? Is that my life? You know, friends, tonight, this week, the rest of our lives is a journey. And I would invite you tonight, this week, to begin that journey. It doesn't have to be. But please, wherever you are in your walk with God, continue it throughout your life, that I might know him.